Right, it's June 6th, 2008. And I'm Will Pratt, and I'm interviewing Dick Nakamura about his experiences as a Japanese Canadian in Canada and his military career. So I guess we can start out with your date of birth and where you were born and biographical information.
Mm-hmm. Well, 11th of May, 1924. It seemed like it was 100 years ago. And in Comox, Vancouver Island, I was born.
And maybe a little bit about your parents?
Yeah, my parents, my dad came to this country in 1907. And he was a citizen in 1915, and he was fishing at that time. And then he got into logging, and then he went back to Japan and got my mother, you know, and she was at Fanny Bay at the logging company when I was born in Comox, right close to Comox. And that's about it.
So what do you remember then, or I guess you weren't around yet, but what was the nature of his work then in Fanny Bay?
Yeah, at Fanny Bay he was, after fishing, he went into a logging company, and it was a Japanese logging company, and he was a foreman of that logging company, and when I was born, and he continued that for a number of years, and then a friend of his, and with a friend of his, he went to start up his own logging company, but it was at the bad time, at the 1928, 1929, so he lost his shirt in the big crash. And so he decided he'd better do something else, and then he went into market gardening, because he came originally from a farm in Japan, you know, farming community in Japan. So here we are in the farming in Surrey, British Columbia.
Right.
Primarily strawberries and, you know, fruits and stuff like that, you know.
Right. And it would have been about 1929 when they moved over to...
1930. Yeah.
Moved to Surrey area.
Yeah, and then after a few years, you know, like, you know how they are, they put everything they had made in, back into the farm, and then... It was only a 5-acre farm, so we needed more land. So then he looked for another farm, and there was a 10 acres about 2 miles away. Couldn't get anything closer.
Right.
And so he bought that, and then so we were working on that quite a bit. And it was one of these things where it was about half. We cleared about half of it, you know, and he used the logging methods for blasting these stumps and trees and gathering them and burning them and stuff like that, you know.
Right.
Yeah, so it was kind of interesting.
Right.
And, but 1941, of course, you know, things were just beginning to get rosy for my parents because, you know, they really worked hard, you know.
Right.
And, just getting rosy when the war started, and of course, the government in their wisdom took the land away and
right.
Supposed to hold it for us till the end of the war, but before the end, they just went and sold it.
Right.
Without our request. Right. So we got back nothing. You know, $200 for 15 acres of land that was producing, and if you were allowed to harvest the fruit and stuff, you know, during the war. Geez, we would have made money.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
But it just laid to waste there. Yeah.
So, was it mostly strawberries then?
Huh?
Was it mostly strawberries?
Oh, yeah, mostly strawberries, yeah.
And do you have any early memories, personal memories of the land or clearing the land?
Had the chores after school, had to help, you know, and this and that. And my folks worked their fingers to the bone, you know, too.
Right.
Yeah. And we belonged to a growers association, you know, and so through them distributed the fruit.
Right.
But Anyway, it was, a part of my life that, I guess it was, that's when I was growing up,
Yeah.
And then this forced removal came about, and that changed my whole way of thinking,
When you were young, and you would have been about 5 or 6 when you moved to Vancouver, so you would have been just starting public school.
Yep.
I guess. And you did that during the day. Was there other Japanese Canadians going
to school? Yeah, it was a farming country district, and a lot of the, in fact, it was Japanese farmers that actually created the farming in that area.
Right. So there was a little community.
Yeah, so there was a lot of, my two of our neighbors were, in fact, one of our original neighbors, she's now 100 years old this year. She's at the Lutheran home right here, right in Victoria here, because her daughter is married and living in Victoria, you see, one of the daughters.
Right.
And so I go to see her every so often.
Right.
Yeah.
So what kind of things would you do with the Japanese Canadians as a community there?
Well, being young yet, in fact, I had a half-brother, my mother was married before, and he was about 5 or 6 years older than I was, and he got tied to, he was one of these guys, he liked to organize too, and he got young people and started in the Strawberry Growers Association's hall, which they use in summertime to haul the berries and stuff. He got permission to set up ping pong tables, and that's how I learned how to play ping pong. He started to set up the ping pong, bunch.
Right.
And so a lot of us learned how to play ping pong then, and so he tried to do something, and that's one of the things I remember. Never did anything else. We had to go to, they had attached to that, they had a Japanese language school.
Right.
And none of us really wanted to go. and then they didn't have that much money, so they used to get the Buddhist minister from U.S. Mission used to come and teach us, you see.
Right.
And one guy had been teaching about 6 different classes of 8, and my class was the senior class, we had about 6 guys, and a girl. He sure had a time with us because he said, you guys go outside and on the steps and read while I'm teaching the other guys. So we go out and he never sees us again that day. And the next time, we sure get held, in a teachers and parents meeting, we're the subject of with the parents all the time.
Right. Yeah. So it was very much your parents wanted you to be doing.
Oh, yes, yeah. But, I wish the heck I did study, because that would have been much more useful to my own country.
Right.
When during the war, they wanted linguists and stuff like that.
Of course.
But I was able to at least speak, a certain amount, and this and that. And they wouldn't have to train me too long into the military that I would be a use to them,
Right.
So when I heard about it, I was barely 17 or something like that, and I... 17 and a half, I guess, 18, and I tried to get in there, and they recruited from out east, and they were in Winnipeg, and I never heard about it being a field, sugar beet field,
Right.
When I did hear, I found out the Winnipeg office number, and I phoned them, but it was too late. They had the quota,
Right. They were only taking 200 people
or
something.
I was so disgusted,
This is the S20 language school.
Yeah. So I wanted to... I thought, gee, the Americans have, their own Japanese-American thing, and I thought, geez, I could go and join them.
Right.
Just at the age when you wanted to do something.
Right, yeah.
And, of course, I couldn't go across the border, so I asked the Mountie to check it out to see if they let me go across to join them.
Right.
And he did a thorough job. He came back right out to the sugar beet fields. He said, I tried everything, but they won't let you through, so I couldn't go across the line.
Right.
Maybe that's why I'm still alive. I don't know.
Very well be,
Those guys were, they weren't, those guys just, they had, they were fighting an enemy and they were fighting prejudice. So,
right.
And they had two wars to fight. And, obviously did a pretty good job at that.
Now, so in these early days in Surrey area, do you remember any racial hostilities between Asians and whites or anything like that, or personal prejudices you experienced?
Well, you know, as a kid, you know, I never understood a lot of that going to public school and stuff like that.
Right.
But the teachers were really good in the public school. Mm-hmm. God, I'm telling you, they went on their way to, you know, sort of get us, you know, involved. And as a result of that, I got along good with my classmates, you know. They were good friends and, you know, things like that. But never thought, until later on when I started to realize that, you know, they wouldn't, why did the Japanese people live in communities? Mm-hmm. Why did they stick to themselves and stuff? And I thought, boy, that was stupid, you know, they come to a country, you know, and this and that. And because, you know, in out east, you know, they immigrants from Italy and Germany and everywhere else, they come in and within a year they can speak English and they're, you know,
right. Straight
up. Not Japanese people. So I was really pissed off at that part.
Right.
But I realized that as I grew older and started reading and then hearing more, that the reason was that they weren't allowed to, nobody hires them. And they weren't allowed to go to university to take certain class courses
right. Because,
you know, they're Japanese. And so they were sort of coerced into living amongst themselves.
Right.
So I thought, yeah, you know, I had the wrong idea.
Right.
And a lot of people did too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In a lot of the histories and people writing about this area, there's a tension between the second generation and the first generation, the Nisei and the Issei, right? Do you experience conservatism from your parents or the elders?
Oh, yes. I know that when the war started, my dad said it can't be helped. He says, you know, whenever there's a war, the governments are, you know, fighting, and he says, this time, he says, it's our turn to suffer. And I said, what a baloney. You know? I sure got mad at him, you know. But that's the way it was. And I remember about 2 years before the war, an RCMP plainclothesperson visited all, they checked all the Japanese families because they could see things happening. And they interviewed my parents and my mother explaining, you know, she was, my mother was more educated than my dad was, you know, but anyway, so she said something in Japanese and this Monty, you know, he's supposed to know Japanese, you know.
Right.
My dad said he wouldn't understand that kind of language, you know, and he was mad, you see.
Right.
And I'm sitting there watching all this, and the Monty says, oh, yes, he says, I understand, you know,
right.
In Japanese. I laugh like hell, you know, I remember. Yeah. And my dad was really surprised. Yeah.
Yeah.
Those guys knew the Japanese.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So these would have been the RCMP coming around to make everyone register, right? And do you remember having to carry a registration card or anything?
Oh, yeah. Like well, after when the war started, just before the naturalization card. In fact, I have one downstairs yet. I should have brought it up to show you. But it's a picture on there. It says next, Canadian born. But we're all, you know, classed overall as MEAs, you know, but the bottom of mine is called Canadian born,
right?
Yeah. And I know my brother and guys his age, you know, they have to assist in registering all the Japanese Canadians.
Right.
Yeah. So anyways, you know, this is war and the governments do things, strange things, at, you know, at the same time. Can't do anything about it. But the one thing was that there was a Japanese Canadian newspaper at that time. Started, you know, just before. That's the guy up there, Nathaniel. He became a deputy minister of finance. And he became a good friend of mine, you know, because I knew him from before. In fact, he was one of the university students. In the summertime, they used to have about 5 or 6 of these students come to our association, and they handled the berries.
Right.
Oh, yeah, okay. They had guys driving trucks, picking it up and sorting it out and then shipping and taking it to Vancouver. And I thought, boy, what a bunch of guys, you know. I'm going to be like those guys, you know. And that guy, he was one of them. And so he knew who I was, you know. So along the years, you know, in Saskatchewan and southern Alberta visit. Every so often I see him, you know, and he always had time to talk to me.
Yeah. Now, this is the New Canadian newspaper? Yeah. And what's the gentleman's name?
Tom Shilyama.
Right on.
He was the editor.
Right on. So when you heard of outbreak of war, do you remember your family's reaction and your personal reaction to Canada being at war?
Well, you know, we were out in you can tell us things were brewing, but we didn't, you know, the war hadn't started at this time. And we, by this time, we had this farm, up, you know, 2 miles away, and my dad, my brother, and I went every weekend to go out there to, you know, dig holes to put powder in and blast them and things like that to clear the land. So this was one day we were out there and we had, we dug holes all, in fact my dad was digging during the week.
Yeah.
And by Saturday, you know, we were putting blasting powder in and stuff like this. And this neighbor came over and says, did you know that the war started in Japan? I said, holy Christ, it's happened.
Yeah.
And I told my dad, he said, that's bullshit.
Didn't believe it, eh?
It was so funny. Yeah. I remember to this day, he gave me hell because he said, that's a bullshit, he said.
Didn't believe that Pearl Harbor had been bombed?
Yeah. But this guy said, it really happened.
Right.
So he says, okay, let's light the stuff that we have and go home. So what we had, my brother put so many in, my dad put so many in that he kept counting them. Went behind the shed that we had built, you know. And as we
come. Like more coffee?
Oh, please. Maybe a half. Half cup. Thanks.
No, I'm okay.
Okay, I'm going to go for a while, but we'll be home.
Okay.
So you went behind the shed?
Yeah, and as it bright, you see, they all had to come.
Right.
But once we lit the thing and blessed it, he never went back in there.
Right.
He wouldn't allow anybody to go back. That was the last thing he did, and if the count was right, that's fine, and then he went home.
Right.
Because a friend of ours, in fact, your relative, you know, one day, he was blasting, and he told us, you keep going and don't come back today because I'm going to blast this big stump and a couple of them. He put a half a box of, you know, blasting powder in there and a number of deals, and they all went, but one didn't go. He waited and waited, and nothing happened. And then he finally he went to check, which he shouldn't have. He just left it for the day, but he went back to, I guess it was Neen Donner.
Killed
him.
Yeah.
And my dad, you know, in his logging days, you know, he used to do this kind of stuff. He used to blast and things like that for roads and things like this. So once he left those things and they counted, and even if the count was right, never went back in there that day. He just stayed there.
Yeah.
And that was his rule.
Yeah.
But then when you put the caps on the fuse, he didn't have a fire. He goes,
use his teeth.
Yeah. I'll never forget that. Yeah. So anyway, we had that.
Right. So that period right after Pearl Harbor in early 1942, and you talk about the events that were happening there.
Yeah. Well.
What you were hearing. And
yeah. Well, my went home and listened to radio and this and that. Geez, I thought, oh God, we're in for it because, you know, they're gonna. So I went to school the next day, I mean on Monday, and yeah, next day, went to school, and you could tell that was in the minds of everybody, and all the Japanese, there's quite a few Japanese people going to that new, brand new high school, it's called the Queen Elizabeth High School, and the year before, we had to, they bust us into Sapperton, Neil's Mitchell's High School, Junior High School, because, you know, built.
Right.
And so then went to school, and of course the principal called us in and said the school board has said that, you know, we can't take part in any. I was in the cadets, high school cadet corps. We were all ready to go
go to war, you know,
overseas,
because the 39
yeah.
thing.
Right.
And he said, you can't take part in that. That sort of put me off a little bit. And so, anyways, you know, poor principal, you know, he was so good, you know, but
right.
we were mad and we would say anything, you know.
Right.
And he took it all, though, because he knew what the situation was.
Right.
You know? And then a lot of the kids are interesting, you know. One of the older boys, you know, apparently he was buddies, you know, with this, I was his buddy with this guy's kid brother in my class, but the one in the senior class, this fella was a friend of this other older fella. He was interviewed and in the newspaper, you know, and he said, what do you think about, you know, all this? He says, you know, people are saying to move them out and stuff like that.
Right.
And he says, oh, they should, you know. That really pissed me off.
Right.
But his brother, kid brother, he was my friend. You couldn't find a nicer guy anywhere. Real nice guy. And so, you know, I guess, you know, as individuals, you can think any way you want, you know. That year, that next year, he was called up, trained, went overseas, and he was dead. And that was really sad for me. There's another fellow that was a good friend of mine. You know, we were sort of a four or five of us, two, three Japanese Canadians like Bob, you know, and Frank Cherrington, I still remember his name, and Carlson, and there's about six or seven of us in one group. We're
yeah.
all, you know, used to do things together, you know. Yeah. And Charrington eventually went overseas, and then he went to school in England after the war, and then he came back, you know, and he lives in Ladner right now.
Right.
But anyways, rather than at school, you know, God, there's some people that we heard that, you know, they said that they were going to send people out of here and stuff like this, and we got our marching orders, you know, and this and that. And by that time, some of those classmates, you know, they just said, we're going to have a party for these guys. So we had to be in before dark, and, you know, you had to stay home, you know.
Right.
But the local policeman, they talked to him and said, we're going to have a party at this roadhouse, you know, right near the high school
mm-hmm.
on the highway. And he says, they're going to be, you know, for the Japanese people because a lot of them are going away. He says, will you please look the other way or, you know, check. So I remember, you know, during the party, you know, I was out to get a drink or something, and they had all the drinks in a certain area, you know, and it wasn't, no liquor, of course.
Right.
But anyways, here's a policeman, great big 6-foot, you know, motorcycle policeman, you know.
Yep.
And comes in and he's looking, how are you guys, you know, and this and that, and, and he just, you know, talked to him, went away. And,
right.
He was good enough to allow that, too.
Right.
So then at night time, they pick us all up and they take turns and they took us home because we couldn't be on the street.
Right.
So I thought, you know, that was really good, you know, of some of the kids. So there weren't, you know, there's a lot of good kids, you know. Students are usually pretty good, you know. But the odd guy, I suppose, depending upon their parents and stuff like that, you know.
I'd say something.
But nobody said anything to me, you know.
Yeah.
And everybody, the students, you know, they're really sorry about it and this and that, and people crying, you know, and they have to leave and stuff like this, you know. But anyways, next morning, we were allowed 150 pounds or less, you know, each person.
Yep.
So everything was left in the house there, and we just carried what we could take. And on top of that, we had to take kitchen utensils in case we needed. So, you know, so we couldn't take everything we wanted. So I had hid stuff in boxes, you know, left it in my, you know, treasures and things
right.
like that.
Yeah.
And we had to walk about 2 blocks with all this stuff to the road because we were in the country, you know. And the bus came and picked us up and took us into, you know, Westminster to the train. And I remember You're on a train for 2 days, I think. So slow, you know. You just go when the main line isn't working, you just go. And they made us put the blinds down, you know, when they got into the station so nobody see us or we wouldn't know where we were, but shit, we knew where we were. So we got to Calgary. We were being taken to Lethbridge, south of Calgary. When we got to Calgary, it was noon, one day, next day, and they gave us $1 apiece and said, go buy your lunch. You go to some place, they won't feed you. Yeah, they refused to feed us. So me and three other guys were running around, and we went to this place and sat down. And the guy said, gee, they're going to feed us. And, yeah, the son of a gun, you know, this never mattered no hell. Then I realized we were in a cafeteria.
Right. And I had to go up to the counter to get your food, right?
I said, hey, guys, I said, you have to go and get your food. They're not going to come and ask you.
Yeah.
So we'll try it. No problem. We're right through there and got everything right. 1 or 7 or 8. Big laugh, you know.
Right.
This is the look other side, you know. You gotta all these amusing things that happen.
Right.
And good thing you can laugh about it. Yeah. Another place, it happened to be a Chinese restaurant, but it was a restaurant that we went to. Where was that? No, there's some other place. Mm-hmm. And some place that we didn't even go in because they said, you know, they won't feed you, so you can do it. This place will, so it happened to be a Chinese restaurant, but
right.
Went in there, and I got something, and, you know, she's talking, and then I pushed it down, my plate went on the floor, broke the dish.
Oh, no.
I thought, oh, shit, I don't have any money to pay for that.
Yeah. Here you are, causing trouble.
Yeah, so anyways, the guy came, and he was pretty good. He said, well, he said, never mind, he says, you know, so, he bought me some other thing.
Right.
So, you know, there's nice people and, you know, all kinds of other people. But
right.
That's when I first experienced the actual, you know,
right.
Discrimination,
right.
Prejudice, you know, when, on that trip.
Yeah.
Then we got to Alberta, to Raymond, and all the farmers came in because they were looking for labor.
Mm-hmm.
And they look at each family to see how many hands that they have, you know, this and that, just to make sure, practically, check your teeth, you know. Yeah, I remember, but this great big Nordic fellow, you know, he was a big guy, Peterson.
Yeah.
He decided to take our family, you know, and I was telling my brother, I said, boy, we're going to have a tough time with this guy, you know, he's a rough looking son of a bitch, you know. And turned out he's the nicest guy you can ever find. He did everything to make us comfortable.
Yeah.
And they were given a certain amount of lumber to build a shack, you know, for us, because we were in a tool shed, you know, and leaking all over the place, everything else. But it was April that we were in there, 22nd of April,
okay.
And we had to stay in there till almost fall.
Right.
But once, you know, summer got better, you know, this and that. And as long as it wasn't raining, it wasn't pouring through the ceiling. Yeah,
when you got there, though, it was pretty crude accommodation,
yeah,
wasn't it?
But anyway, they were given so much lumber to build, and he just added just as much to that, his
right.
own money. But we built the house.
Right.
And we were one of the lucky ones, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. But there's no insulation because no such thing.
Right.
And in wintertime, boy, I'm telling you, you're right near the wall, and if you're, your hand was touching the wall and stuff, the frost, you know, stick to the wall, you know,
right.
That's how cold it was. And then just one pot-bellied stove in the kitchen, you know, and Jesus, it was cold. And coal.
Yeah.
They had lots of coal. He used to take us on a truck to the riverbed and we used to have to get our own coal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, how was it that your family ended up choosing to go to Alberta instead of ending up in one of the camps in BC?
Well, the reason for that, we had an opportunity to volunteer to go to the sugar beet fields as a family.
Mm-hmm.
Or my dad and my brother would have to go to a road camp, and the rest of us go to a ghost town in the interior of British Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad didn't want to break up the family. You know, he said it's important that the family stick together as much as possible as a family. So this is why we volunteered. But I don't know if that was the right decision or not. But I think when you look at overall, I think it was a good thing because, you know, we suffered a lot as a result of it. But I think the idea of keeping the family, it instills something in yourself. Mm-hmm. So like today, I've got two daughters and my son's retired and come out here. And he bought a brand new house here just the other day, you know, last month. And so I've got most of my family in Victoria, except one can't come because she's with the, you know, her husband's family have a business there, and, you know, he's there, and so they'll be there, you know. But oh, she comes, every time she gets a chance, she flies down and flies in, and, you know, so we see her quite often, you know, so we see our family pretty good. So maybe that's what it's done, you know, just to sort of keep us together, you know. So I think, you know, there's family, you know, meant something to my dad, and I think that he's done a good job to in doing that. We may have all suffered a certain amount, but it's paying off because we're sort of stick pretty, you know, keep in touch and, you know, worry about family. So, and I know other families are spread out all over the country, and some of them didn't know what the other half's doing. You know, so there are two ways to look at this, you know. Yeah.
So, do you remember what the provisions were for leaving your property behind? You mentioned you put some of your personal belongings in boxes, but did you just leave the house?
You can't do anything. You just leave it there. Yeah,
it's basically
some guys tried to sell it, but some people sold it. But gee, you know, when you get for appliances and tables and stuff like that, you get a dollar or you know. It's ridiculous. It wasn't worth doing it.
Yeah.
But a lot of people had the neighbor look after it.
Mm-hmm.
And ended up the neighbor sold it.
Right.
Yeah. Good friend, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. But they had the odd occasion like that. Some people, you know, people stole out of the houses and, you know.
Right.
They ransacked our place.
Did they?
Yeah. In fact, they torched it. They used to have parties in there, then they used to torch it, you know. But so all the things I had was gone, you know, burnt, you know. But there's some guys that, some people, you know, the trunks and stuff like that, something just sold it, you know.
Yeah.
When they bought the house, they were allowed to buy it, all this stuff was there, so they just sold it.
Covered and everything.
Yeah, and I know some person, like some of the, a neighbor, or one of the neighbors, said that their son is. She went out there and she bought any trunks and stuff like this and shipped it out to these people.
Right, yeah.
I thought, fabulous, you know. They were good friends, I guess, you know, because they don't do that. Usually, if you can buy a trunk for $1, you buy it and you keep all the,
right.
All the treasures are in there, you know, because the farmers, they come in a farming area, but all the treasures, things like only kimono they had,
right.
And, you know,
yeah.
Stuff like this are all in there.
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, that's what happened. Yeah.
So when you went to Lethbridge then, you were with a bunch of other Japanese-Canadian families?
Yeah, there's people from all over there. In fact, people from South Spring Island and from Main Island and stuff. There's, in fact, I was at an opening of a Japanese garden that this guy built, you know,
mm-hmm.
with another friend. And the Lieutenant Governor was there to open it, too. And I went to that, and a lot of people from that that island was in our towns,
right.
You know, in our area.
Right.
So I knew a lot of these people, you know. So it's funny how after years after, I find out that this is where they came from, you know.
Right.
Yeah. So there are a lot of people of that nature, and we used to... get to know where everybody was, and then I think it was the next 1943, the United Church missionary in the next town, you know, bigger town, 12 miles away, she got some young people together to form a, you know, youth council.
Yep.
And Lethbridge was a town about 20 miles away, but 25 miles was Lethbridge, you know. It's a small town with about 15,000 people, but at that time. Mm-hmm. But we couldn't even go in there without permission.
Right.
Yeah. Even to go to a show, we had to get a RCMP permit to go
right.
25 miles to go to the show.
So you'd have to get like a day pass kind of seat that you were permitted. So did you do, was there any Japanese-Canadian cultural center, so to speak, or events that you participated in?
Luckily in southern Alberta, in a place called Raymond, which was 12 miles away, that town, Raymond area, they had a lot of Japanese-Canadian farmers from way in the early 20s.
Right.
So they went there directly and farmed in southern Alberta. So they were never moved, and for their people, they bought an old Mormon church, I guess, you know, a church hall or something, and that became a Buddhist church for them.
Right.
And so they had a, you know, place to center, so it was a sort of ready-made place, and everybody from southern Alberta went there, you know, to see who's there or where the families are and stuff like that. It became a sort of a central, area that the Japanese Canadians in southern Alberta, you know, went to find things or here.
Even if they weren't Buddhists, they would go
to
the temple.
And they started a store there for Japanese goods, and, you know, a lot of people wanted to buy that.
Right.
Yeah. So that's why there was some communications to find out who was where, you know, because some friends, you didn't know where they were, you know.
Right.
Yeah. So gradually, the usefulness of that church was very, very important, you know, to the Japanese people. And then we used to go there to, people came from the coast, and there are people who used to instruct in judo and the kendo and all these things. So they started that right at that building. So we used to, about four or five of us from McGrath, we used to 20 below, and we'd drive on a jalopy, you know, and go to Raymond, and I was taking judo and kendo, you see, and we finish about 10 o'clock, and we go to a restaurant, you know, that's still open, and you're sweating and everything else, you know, no showers and stuff like this. Gosh, each guy would buy a brick of ice cream. 20 below.
Get your calories back.
So we did that for a number of years, you know. And that's so it kept us busy with some one thing or another. And then we started a baseball team in McGrath. We had to use every guy that was there to make a team.
Right.
And a couple of the kids were just they were barely 15. But they were two of the best players. Twins. Yeah. So we kept busy one way or another, found things to do.
Right. So you started out, when you first moved there, you moved right onto the farm.
Yeah, they took us in a truck and through the country, and we thought, oh, this small town, maybe that's where we're going.
Right.
Then we went through, past the town, and way into the country. I thought, oh, God, where are we going? God, they're about I forgot how many miles past the town, way up there on a farm, and there's nothing around there. You know, it's the odd farm shelter belt, you know, or homestead here and there. So the thing was, I had to go to grade 12.
Yep.
And I couldn't go to school in September because we were busy in the sugar beet fields.
Right.
So I couldn't get to school till middle of October practically, you know. Because sometimes the first year it snowed and we still had to, you know, cold. And the only way I could get to school was walk 2 miles down to the highway, wait for a Greyhound bus, ride 5 miles on the bus to get to school every day, and come back the same way. That was my way to go to school.
Routine.
Yeah.
So what were your duties on the actual beet farm?
Well, we had to sign a contract to look after so many acres of sugar beets for the farmer. We had to thin it, you know, after they seed it, we had to thin the things out to so there's only one, you know, and with a hoe.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look down the road, you know, it's a quarter of a mile, you know, and the hoe is such a long thing, but the whole family had to get out there to do it. And then,
even your mother?
Huh?
Even your mother?
Oh, gee. The tougher thing was for my mother.
Yeah.
I don't know how she did it.
Yeah.
In the morning, she was up, made breakfast, woke everybody, fed, and we went, and she'd clean up, make the lunch, and then she'd come out. Then feed us lunch, and then, you know, we'd be out there, and then before noon, she'd come home.
Yeah.
And prepare lunch, but she's had these things, you know, prepared the day before, you know, but we had lunch, and we'd come home and have lunch, the same thing, procedure again.
Yeah.
And supper time, she comes home early, makes supper, and, you know, in those days, you know, the way the Japanese families were, the guy didn't do anything, you know.
Around the house.
And after he finished, you know, my brother and I, we'd go and read or, you know, lie somewhere, and here's my mother cleaning up and this and that. Never entered my mind. And then she prepared for the next day.
Yeah.
Then on weekends, she does not only that, but she has to do the laundry.
Right.
And, you know, years later, you know, when I woke up, you know, and I was old enough to reason and think a little bit, I used to tell my mother, you know, and I said, I don't know how you did it.
Yeah.
I said, I would have told them to go to hell and I would have.
Yeah. But,
so anyways, I think, you know, I can't say enough for the mothers of families that were in the Shigeru family.
Right.
Boy, it was tough because of the way of thinking of Japanese people at that time, in the old system, you know, the men never touched the, you know, dishes and stuff like that, or laundry, or, you know, stuff like this. Nowadays, heck, it's, you know, I learned a long time ago that you got to do your share.
Right.
And so, lots of times I'll cook, or I just go and clean up, you know, and stuff like that. The family comes every Sunday. The guy clear the tables and everything else and paws up.
Right.
I do the dishes.
A little more egalitarian than that. Than your
takes me a couple of hours.
Yeah.
But it allows Ann and the girls to sit there and chew the fat.
Right. Yeah.
And they do it just about, three Sundays out of the month at least, you know, because other times they're at some other places, you know, and they go. So this is the way life is right now. And I try and, you know, do my share nowadays, you know.
Yeah.
And my son-in-law is the same way. They do dishes and they clean up and stuff. It's amazing. Some of them cook, you know.
So you were, how long were you on the actual farm then?
About 5 years.
5 years, yeah. And it was the same family and the same farm?
Yeah. That farmer was just fabulous.
Yeah.
And while we were there, his wife died, and he had a daughter that he was in the army, and the war finished, he came, son-in-law came back, and he took over the farm.
Okay.
And they had this Peterson family, you know, the daughter, boy, she was 6 feet something, a big girl, you know, yeah. And she had a sister and another brother. Oh, yeah, the brother was there, too.
Huh?
And they're all, I would say the shortest of the kids is 6'2" or 6'4".
Wow.
Oh, that's good. Giants.
Giant Scandinavians.
Yeah, and the boy was, he, too bad, he was, had diabetes, you know, pretty bad. But he liked his drink, you see.
Okay.
And he finally died, you know, after he was married and this and that, he finally passed away. So, I used to go up to the farm to say hello sometimes after we get out. It was the daughter and the son-in-law running the farm.
Okay.
And he was in the army and this and that. No idea about farming. And so the farmer, you know, before he died, he asked me to stay at least another year to help him.
Yeah.
But he has his own ways, you know. He's going to fix the tractor. We had a tractor to do all the seeding and everything else. In the spring, he decides to, you know, overhaul it. And here, everybody's seeding and stuff, and here we're sitting there, you know, and I said, Christ, you got to get that thing going, because you got to get the seed in the ground. Well, you know, he just didn't understand that too well, you know, and Finally, he got it fixed, and boy, we see it night and day, 24 hours. It was a little late, even then.
Right.
And my brother was, we took turns, you know, shifts, 4-hour shifts, you know, and then I take over about, I remember I took over at midnight one day. I'm going there, and all of a sudden I woke up, you know, and I thought, where the hell am I, you know? I didn't know where I was. Right in the, you know, at nighttime, in the middle of the prairies, and here I've got I'm seeding grain.
Yeah.
I don't know where I am. So I, at least I thought a little bit, used my head, and I turned around and followed myself back out to the where the, I left off, and then I kept seeding.
Started again, yeah.
And I figured nobody know about this year. But in the spring, the farm boss, you know, he used to call me Joey, because, you know, I don't know, they give you names, you know. Hey, Joey, just come on over here. So I went over and says, he points to this hillside way up there and says, you went to sleep, eh? I laughed. He's laughing, you know, because he didn't hear about it. And he says, and I can see where I went off the road and way out in the middle of nowhere, and there's a circle there, and I came back, and that place is, you know, drilled twice, eh? You know? You can see the darn thing, you know, the son of a bitch, you know, there's evidence.
You thought you got away with it.
Yeah, that was really interesting. But I learned a lot from that guy, you know,
yep.
You know, different things about farming, and a lot of the things were, it helped with your reasoning too, you know, different things, you know, and like, you know, we had to take the tractor, it's a Caterpillar tractor, you know, he had one of these, about a D2, small one, but pretty heavy. We had to go across the irrigation ditch.
Yep.
That's why we were there on that farm, to look after sugar beet via the irrigation. But he had a bridge over it, and gonna go over and I had the thing, and I came to the bridge, and I thought, boy, that doesn't look very strong. So I went out there, and I jumped up and down on it, you see.
Yeah.
And this farmer, he's laughing away. He says, how can you tell him?
You think you weigh as much as a tractor.
Yeah. So anyways, he said, don't worry, that I've gone over that every, you know. So.
Yeah.
But it was really, you know, when I think back to that, those times, you know, it kind of comes up. I have to laugh about it, but this guy was pretty good. Yeah, big Danish American. He came from the States,
right.
From Utah or something.
And his whole family was out working the fields as well?
Well,
all the kids?
No, the kids were at school.
Okay.
Yeah, some of them were away at probably, not private, but different schools.
Yeah.
And they weren't home.
Okay.
And, but they did come back every so often.
Right.
And
work in the summers?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, but, they're a good family.
Yeah.
Yeah. We were lucky, you know.
How was it for you to go to the high school? You went to high school in McGrath?
Yeah.
For just a single year? Or finish
up? Well, grade 12. Yeah. I left when I was in, because I left early in April, end of April, any marks I had, they cut it down one grade. Some of them more than one. If I had an A, I ended up with a C, C plus. If I had a C plus, I ended up with a D or something.
Because you didn't finish your courses.
Yeah.
That was
so when I went to grade 12, Christ, you know, I was shy of a lot of credits there.
Right.
So anyways, I took everything I could. I even took Economics 1, which is a grade 13 class,
right.
You know. But there was no grade 13 there, but I was allowed to take that because it sounded interesting, and
right.
This and that. But I couldn't put in enough data because I couldn't get to school till October,
right.
At your harvest.
You'd already
then,
missed a couple
when you
months.
Come into May, you got to start hoeing and stuff. So the last after the middle of May, or towards the end of May, I wasn't at school.
Right.
So they dock you for that, too.
Yeah.
So I ended up with, you know, not enough credits to get high. But the principal was very good. He wrote a letter to the education board saying that, you know, this and that, and his former grades are good enough that they shouldn't have, you know, they cut it down because of the days.
Right.
And then, because I didn't have so many days in school in Alberta, they wouldn't give me credit for certain things themselves, you know?
Right.
Economics wanted to say you can't have credit for that, or can't have credit for this because, you know, I only went to school for so many days.
Right. So the relocation really hampered your education then?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, hey. So then what happened was that I was not able to get my, you know, grade 12, let alone, you know, matriculation. Mm-hmm. So he wrote a letter, this and that, and the Board of Education gave me my grade 12.
Right.
So that's the only reason why I got my grade 12.
Yeah.
Then after the, you know, I wanted to go to school because I like school, you know. But then, you know, you got to help feed the family, and, you know, my brother got married and he went away, so I had a responsibility there. So we bought a house in town, you know, somehow we bought a small house in town. And, you know, they were too old to do anything anyway now.
Yeah.
And so we moved into town, and I got a job at the store, you know, for a while, and things like that.
Right.
So that's how we managed. And then I got to the point where I couldn't get a job because I didn't have any training.
Right.
So how do I get that? And they refused. During grade 12, I went to try to get in to be an air gunner, you know, but they wouldn't have me, but
right.
my friends got in,
yeah.
But not me.
Yeah.
And I came home madder than hell, but anyways, of the three guys, the only one is living, you know, two. One is lost over Europe, and the other guy lost in the Atlantic.
Right.
And the third, the only reason why that guy's living is because his parents asked the department not to send him overseas because they already lost one son.
Right.
He was mad because he couldn't go overseas.
Right.
But, you know, if it wasn't for that, he would have been gone too, and they had a big, big farm.
Yeah.
So that's why he became a rich farmer. You know.
Right.
Yeah.
So you had been in the cadets then, when the war started out then?
At the start, in the Queen Elizabeth High School. Yeah,
right.
And I was
still
in grade 11.
Right.
Yeah.
But did you continuously want to kind of join the Canadian Army during the war?
I wanted to be a part of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then that's why the three of us went to Lethbridge to get in. They were calling for air gunners.
Right.
And this was what, 19... went there in 42, 43, it was about 44.
Right, yeah.
But they wouldn't have me. Then I heard about the S-20, the Lingus thing, and
yep.
I was too late for that.
Right.
Then then they wouldn't let me across the line to join 442nd.
Right, so you tried a number of routes before you crossed.
So I gave up.
Yep.
And then after the war finished, I put in an application because I had no trade, no training.
Right.
Couldn't go to school because I had to work and this and that. So finally, I thought, only way is, you know, my sister came home, you know, and looked after them, and I just, decided I better get it. I couldn't pay to go to a trade school, so, but then at least if I can get in the Air Force, you know. So they took me, and the trade, and that's how I spent 5 years in the RCF.
Right.
I don't regret that one bit. I really thoroughly enjoyed it. I even went to Korea, you know,
yep.
And I was there for 6 months.
Yep.
And we had some fighter pilots that were attached to American fighter groups.
Mm-hmm.
There was only about a half a dozen of them, you know. But then I just went to Korea to find them and, you know, take pictures, destroy them, and stuff like that.
So how did you get into photography?
Well, I'll tell you. Before we moved, I was just getting interested in cameras. This is 1940-41.
Yeah.
As a high school kid, you know, I was just interested in. I was hoping someday I'd like to buy a camera, you know, but impossibility in those days at that time. But, you know, interested. And then before we moved, I got a second-hand camera. Got it from a guy, you know, real simple camera, you know, and. Oh, heck, I saved money to buy film, you see. But then we moved, so nothing happened.
Right.
And then there's an irrigation ditch just by the house you used to go by, you know. So what I did was I'd buy the chemicals, you know, and I'd develop the film.
Yep.
And develop it, and they had these lights with the sort of a darkroom light type of thing, you know, that you can still see something. And I developed a damn film, and I, what do you do, you know? So I stuck it in the irrigation dish to wash it.
Right.
And you know what's amazing? I wish I had that, kept that. I might have chucked it out, but I've kept it for a long, long time. But you know, when you're washing that irrigation dish, the film gets coated with the fine sand.
Right.
And boy, it's quite a, you know, effect on all the pictures, you know.
Right.
I thought I spoiled everything, but I sort of, oh, heck. This is too bad. I kept it for quite a few years, and I don't know, it may still be in my last bunch of junk I have,
right.
But if I can find that, I think I can make some pictures that would be worth, putting out in the exhibition, because, God, the fine sand.
Interesting film, yeah.
In fact, I'd like to do that again, just on purpose, you know.
Yeah. Find yourself in the irrigation ditch. So you got, you joined the RCAF in 1948?
Yep.
And you went straight into photography as a trade?
Well, they sent me to Manning Depot for 2 months to learn how to, you know, all the stuff, you know, tests all the time, and trying to alert you and this and that. And so we were a whole bunch of us, and in that time, there was, I think I was the post-war, I was the first Canadian of Japanese ancestry in the RCAF.
Right.
I still remember my number. It's 12759. That was 1948. But anyways, we went to Manning Depot for 2 months, and all you do is run, march, learn how to march, you run, swim, do tests.
Yep.
And so that's how I met one or two guys that we went through. Then some photography guys went to Rock Cliff. They sent us to Rock Cliff.
Right.
And the course was not going at that time, so they put us in a big place where they, the aerial photographers process these big prints, you know, of air photos.
Right. And this is mapping Canada.
Yeah. So you got a printer, a big printer with 39 lights up there. 39, not 40. 39 lights. And there's a switch for each one.
Right.
So that when the aerial camera takes pictures, if a cloud shadow is moving, it takes the whole thing, you know.
Right.
So when you're printing, you've got to move the shadow with the, so you turn lights out, turn right. lights off, you see.
Right, very manual.
Yeah. So anyway, they put you in there, and then one guy has to print, another guy develops it, and then anybody can do that
right.
anytime, you know.
Yeah.
So, but if you do it, we're printer of the month, or the week, printer of the week, you printed the most prints, and so you and the guy who developed it get a half day off, Friday.
Right, well, I accept it.
So you used to work at that son of a gun to do it, but every so often you get a bad one and the cloud moves across, another one starts, you got a hell of a time printing that.
Right.
So you can't print much.
Right.
But if you get a good one and say, okay, John, this is it. So you get a day off, we go. But it's kind of fun that way, but fine, we have to wait a few months. We have to wait 3 months before a course started.
Right.
That's what we were doing. Then the course was 6 months. It was the most complete photographic course you could find, because it included projections and stuff, projectors and how to do that kind of stuff too. But it wasn't too long, a year or so later, that you changed the course into three pieces.
Mm-hmm.
So you had to go to take the one, and then you got to go again and that kind of thing. That way, but when I went, I was in course 12, and we got the whole damn shooting match.
Block.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
6 months of that.
Right.
So after I got that, we go back to the place where they're doing all these things.
Right.
They had studios for portraiture, they had these air photo things, and they had the copy areas, and the whole industry is in this big building.
This is in Rockcliffe?
Rockcliffe.
Yeah.
And so, after, a couple of months of that, I thought, I didn't come here to do this kind of thing that they could teach somebody in 1 hour, So I had an interview with the old man, and I said, either I get to use a camera where I can, you know, be posted somewhere where I can use a camera, or I want to get out. Because that's what I came to do, is learn to do, you know, handle camera. He says, give me a month.
Yeah.
So they knew that, I guess they got orders of getting me out of the darkroom and putting me into a place where you sort prints and, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
So the NCO in charge of that place, he was going to university himself, as a flight sergeant. But he's a storyteller, and all the same guys around him, he's telling them stories, and he tells me and this other guy, twice in a row to clean and sweep the flooring. You only have to do that once a week, you see. But twice in 2 days, I'm sure I looked at the son of a gun, you know, but we did it. When he said it the third time, I just got the broom and slammed it on the floor and looked at him and I said, shove it up your ass, sir. And I walked out and he said, oh, my friend, you know, their jaws dropped because I never, you know, say anything like that. And I stomped out of the room, went up to the barracks, got my shaving kit waiting for the MPs to pick me up, you see.
Right.
Because you can't get away with that. But you know, this guy, I think he knew he was in the wrong.
Right.
And knew why he was doing this. Upstairs, nobody heard anything except through the, you know, guys telling each other. So I went back and they all came out laughing like mad, you know. Boy, you sure told him, you know. And I said, oh, I'm waiting for the MPs. Oh, let's go for supper. So we went for supper and came back. Nothing happened. So I said, let's go to the show. So we went to the show and I figured they'd catch me at the gate coming back. Nothing happened.
Right.
Never heard anything else about it. Next day I went to work and he doesn't say anything.
Hmm.
You know?
Yeah. He knew he was in the wrong.
Yeah. Then about 2 days later, I got posted uptown.
Right.
They just started the, Korea had started, you see, up in July 50, and this was, they posted me uptown, and this happened in, oh God, I was waiting to move up, you know.
Yeah.
And then, so I was moved uptown in September, and at that time, the CEO, he was at Rockford too, but him and another flight sergeant, they put him on the, and they photography and they took pictures of the airlift.
Yeah.
But then by this time, they're running out of pictures after, you know, 3-4 months, you know.
Yeah.
And by December, they said, we've got to send somebody, so I was the guy.
Right.
And I never had too much experience yet at that time with the speed graphic, you know, the big thing. That's all I had.
Right.
And so anyways, that's how I got to Korea.
Right. So when were you sent to Korea? 51 would it be?
Or? January 51.
Right. Yeah.
And I came back in June, middle of June.
And were you based out of Japan, or how did you...
Right in Japan, right on. Yeah. Right in Tokyo, and the 46th Squadron, their headquarters, I mean, their place where the planes were was Haneda Airport,
right.
You know, the main airport.
Right.
And from there, I take some of the aircrew down to southern Japan to an American base and then get on an American plane and go into Korea and
right.
To go to different places. I do stories of our aircrew visiting, you know, different bases and stuff like that. So I was in and out of there quite often.
Right.
And they sent me out in such a hurry that I even got my last needle in the Tacoma, you know, where the aircraft,
right.
McCord Air Force Base.
Right.
And so that's why they sent me on temporary duty. But the letter saying this man should be on, you know, special forces or
right.
attached to a squadron, but nothing happened. And we only had a few days anyway, so
right.
I was packed and had my needles and off I went.
Off you went.
And next thing I know, I'm in Japan.
Yeah.
And on temporary duty.
Yeah.
And if I had thought a little bit, but you don't think about things like that, you know, because you're not worried about how they're going to, you know, do this. So here, on temporary duty, if you're there on temporary duty, you have to spend 30 days in Korea or something, you know, and stuff like that. That all kinds of stupid rules. But if you're attached to the squadron, then you're part of it,
right?
And I was, even squadron guys never get into Korea, but I was in and out of there quite often. And, those guys are wearing their medals, but I don't,
right?
You know, because of the little thing that says temporary duty.
Yeah.
So I'm making a last-ditch effort, even today, to the new ombudsman of the Veterans Affairs.
Right.
Yeah, and I got support letters from Legion and from the Bank of Ireland Legion and headquarters and Korea Veterans Association. They both have supporting letters for me. And,
right, to get your status as a Korea veteran.
So send it in and say, if I don't get it, don't get it. You know, that's the last time.
So what was Japan like? This would have been 5 or 6 years after the dropping of the bombs, the end of
the
war.
Yeah, well,
what was your experience like?
Things were rough.
Yeah.
Really bad. Yeah. But it was the Korean War that brought them, helped them
raise
back up because of the business.
The economy.
Everything else, the economy. And
so was there lineups for goods during the time you were there?
Oh, yeah. And different things and a lot of MPs and, you know, but it gave a lot of jobs to some of these gay people that can speak English, you know.
Right.
And some of the linguists, Japanese Americans had trained about close to 6,000 guys in linguists, you know, language, and they had them in every fighting formation had one or two of them.
Right.
And a lot of them got shot by their own men because, you know,
because
you're physical, you know. So they started this buddy system. I think that's where the buddy system started.
Right.
Because it had to be one white American soldier and one of these S-20 Niseis. They had to, when they're in the front, they had to travel together.
Right.
So that they know that this guy's his buddy.
Right, yeah.
And then they sometimes they'll sneak across and come back, and they get shot by their own people. And every invasion, there's about half a dozen of them went in with the waves, you know. Every landing in the
border,
London got killed and wounded that way.
So what were your specific duties then in Japan and Korea?
Well, to get stories.
Mm-hmm. So you're working with the press branch?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I issued photographs to an American Trans-Pacific, and it's a military paper, and I used to give them the stuff, but I used to send the stuff back, ship it back to Ottawa.
Yep.
Yeah.
Did they tell you that you had your mission was to take pictures of Canadian air crew, or was it pretty much anything goes?
Well, primarily anything to do with Canada.
Mm-hmm.
If it was a Canadian airman and Canadian soldiers, that was fine too.
Right.
And then we had pilots in the American squadron, so it was in there. Then I took pictures of the air crew. You know, visiting certain Korean places and talking to Korean people and, you know, just to show that they were in Korea.
Right.
You know. It's a PR thing, you know.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. So did you spend most of your time with a single squadron?
In fact, I was attached, you know, they should have attached me to a squadron. But even after I got back, before I left, they were saying this man should be on Special Forces or something. And, you know, it was dragging along, and they couldn't do it in a day, so, you know, they sent me on TV for 6 to 8 weeks, and that's how I left.
Right.
So once I was gone, that was it.
Right.
And then after I got back, I applied for gratuities and stuff, and they said, I'd have to be, headquarters said, this man, you know, should be attached to the Special Forces or to the squadron, you know, even in, you know, post-dated.
Right.
And, or affidavit, or what do you want? I guess it's both of
them.
And anyway, it ended up, and I got my gratuities. And they sent me the Korea Voluntary Service Medal, and you don't get those things unless you're a Korean veteran.
Yeah.
But they won't give me the Korea-Canada medal.
Right. Yeah.
Because I'm on TV or something.
Right.
But anyway, I got all this proof that they were trying to put me in there, and they should have. Right. But I left the Air Force in 1953, so, you know.
Right.
I think that everything stopped at that time.
So, did you see Canadian Army servicemen in Korea, or mostly
just
airmen?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I took pictures with our people with them, and General Rockingham with our, Air Commodore, and I used the Canadian Army PR office right in town.
Right.
They had an office, we didn't, but we were just at the air base. But I used their office for any official thing.
Right. Yeah. Did you go up to the front at all in Korea?
Or? They wouldn't let me go up to the front.
Yeah.
But we were in, the closest I went to the front was they retook a field just a few days before. Everything is still burning. And I got pictures of that, and all the buildings were gone, you know, burning were gone. And you can see the, you know, flashes way over the next mountain.
Right.
And when we landed, gee, there's all these black holes and stuff, I guess, you know, where the canned guns are firing.
Right.
And the landing fields are mesh, all this mesh. You know, like, how in the heck are we going to land on that with a load of ammunition?
Right.
Jeez, like this, you know. When just as you land, you see this. Oh, Christ. Just hold your breath, you know.
Yeah. So for your transportation from Korea to Japan, would you just be kind of on any plane that was heading kind of thing?
Mostly with Americans. Yeah.
Right on.
Americans looked after us, flying in there and back.
Right.
And then finally, towards the end, the first Canadian aircraft to land in Korea, went to a few bases there. There was an air commodore that came. He had one arm, you know. One hand was missing because in a crash in eastern Canada, they went to save this, you know, the guys, and somebody had an axe or, you know, swung.
About him, yeah. You remember his name?
So he's got just a fake hand.
Right.
But that was the Air Commodore. He was the one that was a senior man that was the first to get into, you know, Korea with the SEO.
Right.
And I was part of that. And so we met General Rockingham and met the Canadian soldiers and stuff. They went to different places. We went to this place called K-17, Kumsang or something. And it was the one of the furthest, closest to the... And they took the Air Commodore, the Americans, they took the Air Commodore on just to see.
Yep.
And so I just jumped on with my camera, you know, and said, you can't go. Yep. He said, the Air Commodore is covered, but you're not. And
right.
He said, if you go and get hurt, he said, I'll have my head off, so you can't go.
Right.
I said, I got to be with him. I said, no, you don't. So anyways, he would let me on this six Jeep, you know, deal. So just at the end, when they started, I see that there's an empty seat there. So I ran up there and jumped in there. So they hid, you see.
Right.
And by gosh, I went by and said, oh, thank goodness, you know. And the big yell went out. And they stopped the thing. And said, I thought I told you not to go.
Yeah.
I had to get out. That was the saddest moment because I could have, you know, seen something.
Right.
I saw flashes in the distance, but this is where he was going.
Right.
Yeah. And I just thought, Jesus Christ. So, but the Army, before I came home, the Army, I knew them from the Ottawa office, you see, that's Colonel Stewart, you know, and he says, why don't you transfer to us and stay, you know, come back or stay? Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, he didn't say anything else. He said, we'd like to have you because, like, the way you work and stuff, you know, and you know. Well, when you get back and you think about it, and you think, gee, Air Force or Army, you know, who's crazy enough to do that, this and that. This is what we're thinking, you know, at that time.
Yeah.
But somebody should have said, if I went over there, I could have gone to school, university, on credits and stuff like this.
Right.
If somebody had pounded that into me, I would have gone over.
Gone to school. Yeah.
But I hate to leave my CEO because you're so good to me, you know.
Right.
And I was filling a vacancy that was a covered... is a position for his commissioned officer. So he was waiting, you know, trying to get me trained to go in there. But if I went to join the Army and stuff like that, they might have given me 3 hooks, you know, to go.
Right.
Yeah. Which is okay.
Yeah.
But that wasn't it. You know, just told me that I could go to university after. Oh, geez, I would have jumped.
Would have jumped at it.
Yeah.
So when you came back from Korea then, where were you stationed?
Headquarters.
Headquarters?
Yeah. So after that I traveled all over the north, you know, and overseas to Europe and different countries, you know, when the chief of the air staff went, I went too, you know.
Right.
For a single guy, it was a great job.
Right.
I really enjoyed it. Yeah.
Are there any particular photographs that you took during your time at the RCF that come to mind as
during the world? Yeah. There's a few that I'm trying to find them now.
Yeah.
But if you ever saw igloos, pictures of igloos with lights shining through,
yep.
Some of the early ones I shot
right.
up in what's that place? Beyond Tuktoyaktuk, it's a winter training. There's okay. Cambridge Bay and, you know, stuff like that. And then another shot that I remember is I was sent to the government house to shoot a picture of the chief of the air staff, Curtis, and Governor General was, at that time, was Alexander. Remember, he was Alexander Tunis, you know?
Oh, yeah, of
North
course.
Africa?
Yeah, yeah.
He was the Governor General at that time. And two bulldogs, you know, never smiled. You'd never seen a smiling picture of those guys anywhere. And after I took the formal pictures of him, he was, well, they said, he had been the controls of the RCF aircraft hours enough to be allowed to have the pilots.
Honorary pilot.
Way up here.
Right.
I almost laughed because I've been out of control of these aircraft a hell of a lot more than he has.
Yeah. You know, but
they wouldn't think of giving me a wing, you know. But anyways, they took the pictures and had them, the two of them together, you know, formal pose and everything else. And then I thought, Jesus Christ, what a morbid bunch, you know. I said, Sarah, I said, do you think I can get a smile from you guys? They thought that was funny. Bang, I got. I think I have the only smiling pictures of the Governor General and the Curtis, two bulldogs. And my boss saw it, he laughed like mad, you know. He said, you got the shot of the lifetime. He said, I had a picture, a print of it in my bag, and I can't find it.
Yeah.
I think either somebody took it or I gave it to somebody.
Yeah.
So I'm going to try and, before if I ever get to Ottawa on this trip, that's where I'm going. I'm right. going to, because I know the lady that's in charge of that in D&D part.
Right.
And I'm going to tell her I want to find these certain pictures.
Right.
There's one picture I want to find. I want to get a big one.
Yeah.
And the igloo picture. When the prince and princess, you know, the queen was just before the year before the coronation. Mm-hmm. She was in Ottawa, and my boss. We had one pass that would go anywhere. There's only a few of those given.
Yeah.
And so he'd take it and take some pictures and stuff. And he says, your turn. So he gives me that pass and we change. And then, so I go right into the band, you know, and when she comes, I take a picture. And she was talking to the prime minister and, you know, right out in the thing, nobody else is there. I just go up there and, man, I got oh, such a young, youthful-looking couple. Beautiful picture, you know. Oh, God. So those two pictures, the one, that one, and then the, oh, yeah, my boss and I were allowed 6.5 minutes to take a portrait of her in the sitting in the RCF aircraft when she arrived. So those are the two pictures that of the royal visit that I really, you know, admire.
Yeah.
That's the one when she was here a few years ago, I gave to show food for thought, you know.
Right.
And they took it home. And that's the letter that came back because I asked, where the hell are those pictures? So there's, you know, the odd picture in my 5 years that I really, you know, and the, you know, the president's, vice president's finger licking picture.
Right, you know. Right. This is, George Bush when he was vice president. Herbert Walker. Right.
Nice guy.
Yeah. So maybe just a word about your involvement, early involvement in Japanese-Canadian associations. This it would have started way back when you were even in...
1943.
Right. Yeah.
I got the hankering for it because I felt, you know, we had to do something.
Mm-hmm.
And... So I just got involved with things, and then they formed the Japanese Canadian National Association, and Lethbridge chapter was in that. And then I went away in the Air Force and came back, and they asked me to sit in there again. And then after I came back, then I was involved with the Southern Alberta group. And then I went to Regina, and of course I organized the Regina group. There's not too many Japanese people there. But I got things started there, different things, and finally I ended up in the national group, and then I moved out here, and then I got involved with Vancouver, and never stopped after that.
Yeah. So most of this would have been organizing and collecting names for distributing information and that sort of political
organization? Yeah, well, it was they were trying to build a different communities for support, for the general support for redress. Mm-hmm. And that's why there was one area that wasn't organized.
Right.
So I was asked to do that.
Right.
And I did that. And then I was on the national, you know, human rights. I was in charge of human rights for about 2-3 years for the national committee.
Right.
And then I was with the council. I was at the council, you know, quite often.
Yep.
You know, council meetings and stuff like that. And, but I felt that, you know, from Vancouver, and there had to be more people involved.
Right.
So I used to take, you know, assistant or, you know, we were allowed one observer, so I used to take somebody that there was interest in upon some. The ones that were interested, I took, you know.
Right.
And finally, I got them to go instead of me going.
Right.
Because we had to train other people. I've always believed in that, you know, that you can't do something yourself and hog it just because things are going good. You train other people and let them try.
Right. Share the responsibilities.
Yeah, yeah. Because you got to build the future, you know.
Yeah. And how do you feel about the redress process in general? Do you think it was effective and enough, or well organized?
Yeah, well, actually, you know, there's a lot of things. Hindsight is easy, you know,
right.
Look at it. But under the circumstances, those guys did a hell of a good job.
Right.
And they really, we had to fight a lot, you know, with the different ministers. They wanted to help, but they just didn't understand.
Right.
And their understanding was really bad, some of them. Some of them were really good, others were useless, you know.
Right.
But ended up with a minister of, his name was Weir, you know. Wiener.
Yeah.
Wiener, yeah. Not Weir, Wiener. And prime minister?
Mulroney, yeah.
Yeah, he was my prime minister at that time. And I know Trudeau said, yeah, he wouldn't do it, you see.
Right.
But Hargreaves, I mean, not Mulroney said they would do it.
Yeah.
And Wiener was his minister. Wiener is Jewish, you see.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And then the one that was another cabinet minister that was in the federal government at that time, was Bouchard.
Okay.
Remember, he left the federal government mad and went back to Quebec?
Yeah.
Well, he would help the winner, too.
Right.
So we had two guys really pushing this.
Right.
And the prime minister going along with it, we finally got it. Yeah. And I remember the president, like Art Mickey, phoning me from Ottawa, you know, he says, listen to the 8 o'clock news tomorrow morning.
Right.
Because I think they had just got through that. And he was telling me to come to Ottawa, you know, if I could, but I didn't have any money to go to Ottawa.
Right.
And those guys, so, but I said, you know, so this next morning I turned the radio on, there it was.
There's the announcement, yeah.
Oh, geez, I just, it felt so good, you know, that, I remember us, tears were coming out, you know, because we fought for that for years, you know, and it was really an emotional thing for me. And I wish I was there. I had gone, you know, I was able to be there because I was asked if I should, you know, to go.
Yeah.
But, you know, this happened, and the negotiating committee, you know, in hindsight, I have, couple of things I wish the people that were never moved, like the farmers that were in Kelowna and the farmers in southern Alberta, shit, they had farms and times were good and they're selling their stuff, everything else, and they wouldn't help us too much.
Right.
Some of them did, but some of them said, it's none of our business, you know. Then when it came time for the money, they're out there too and they get it.
Right. Yeah.
And that pissed me off to no end. I really felt, that
people that were affected by the relocation should be the people that should proceed.
They didn't lose that. We lost our farms and, you know, everything.
Yeah.
And people lost their houses and stuff, and here these guys are making money, and selling their stuff and laughing all the way to the bank, and here they get an extra $21,000.
Yeah.
That put me off. And I think that kind of thing should have been brought up at a council meeting and discussed who should be, you know, they should go for it. Because it's primarily for the people that were within the 100-mile zone that were moved.
Right.
Not for people that weren't moved.
Right.
But they even fought for people that went back to Japan and stuff like this. Well, for the Canadian citizens, that was fine with me, you know.
Yeah.
Because they were entitled to that. But not the people that were living, you know, in farming and east of the 100-mile zone.
Right.
But anyway, that's the only thing I have against, you know, the decision that they made.
Yep.
But otherwise, they did a tremendous job. And then, of course, the government gave us, $18 million or $12 million. $12 million for rebuilding the community.
Mm-hmm.
We had also asked that they form a human rights committee, you know, a commission or something, with $20 million to, you know, use. And so they did that, the federal government. That $12 million that they have for community, we put aside money for, on the foundation. They were the people entrusted to look at the requests for, you know, money and dole it out. And I was elected by BC organization to be their representative. I was kind of flattered, you know, that they would, So I was on that committee of 10, right across the country, only 10 of us, and BC asked that I be, you know, on that committee. So I was kind of flattered. There's only, of the 10, I think there's only 5 of us that were elected by the people.
Right.
Others are because they were with the national president or the national executive, or some we appointed a lawyer, you know, and this and that.
Right.
So there's only half of us that were actually appointed, I mean elected, you know. So I was kind of, proud that I was able to, you know, help out that way. But I learned a lot, too, because I didn't know nothing, you know. But being involved in the redress movement through the committee and council and all these years, of course, you know, builds up your, you know, knowledge.
So what were your duties with the Human Rights Council, then?
What's that?
What were your specific duties when you were with the Human Rights Council?
Well, the usual thing.
Yeah.
In every area local, you get somebody to, you know, look into the human rights laws that were made, you know, during the war and this and that, and find those things. And we started to build a file as to what human rights, you know, violations there were there, and what good groups were doing, and what. So it took, I was there for 3 years, and it took that long to get all this information so that we can start doing something, you know. In the meantime, we were doing certain things.
Yeah.
But it was interesting for 3 years.
Yep.
You know? But after that, I said, you know, enough is enough.
Yep.
Somebody else should do that, you know.
So getting back to your career history, when you were done with your 5 years in the RCAF, what was your motivation? Did you want to continue with the RCAF, or had you had enough? Or
I almost went back.
Yeah.
They asked me to come back,
yeah.
And they promised they'd bring me back in as a sergeant. I was a corporal when I left.
Mm-hmm.
I was LAC when I went to Korea.
Yeah.
And when I got my corporal's hooks, the majority of the photographers were in Rockcliffe, you see.
Right.
And the big hall went up because I was one of the later guys, you know, to get a, you know, and to for them to give me a hook in those days, you know, it was pretty early.
Yeah.
And some of the guys were quite mad, you know. But then, to give me back, they were going to give me my third hook and fill that commission position and a promise of a commission within a year. My actual CEO came to see me in Calgary, you know, I met him in Calgary.
Yeah.
I was in Lethbridge at that time. But I got married in between. So, if it was just me, I would have gone.
Yeah.
But he didn't want me to go back, so yeah. I said, I took that off. And so, but then the job came up in Regina, so I went to Regina.
Right.
And while I was there, somebody talked me into joining the infantry city's regiment.
Right.
I said, well, okay, you know, I'm interested.
Yeah.
So I joined that, and then I spent a lot of time trying to qualify as an infantry officer.
Right.
And that's what my CO was happier than hell when I said, sir, I said, do you think I can qualify as an infantry officer? He said, of course you can. That's what you should do.
Yeah.
So here we so. He did everything he could to make sure I got an everybody course, got to know him. Geez, I can, you know, take a rifle apart and bring it like a machine gun. And, you know, some courses I was with recruits, you know.
Right,
yeah. Compass reading and, you know, compass marches and stuff like that. So I went through the whole thing, and then I had to go to an officer's, you know, school to, you know, and this was in Wainwright.
Okay.
And then I was somewhere else, and then I came to Victoria here to Work Point Barracks,
right,
to qualify for my to qualify for senior ranking to become a major.
Right.
And there's only 7 of us on the course, the winter course, and a great bunch of guys. We were at the midnight every night. You know.
Yeah.
A lot of times the guys go on the course and they bug around and, you know, they don't do anything or something like that. But I was determined I was going to do okay, and so were the rest of the guys, so it was really good. And so I got back, and not too long after I got my majority, and so they gave me a company, and I look after a company and stuff like this. It was a, you know, all these things, you know, if you apply yourself, it's good education. It's a, you know, I didn't have a university degree, so I was more, you know, got a hold to learn more things, and,
right.
And then I took night classes to help me with my, you know, other things, but I sure wanted to go to university band, and when I retired, I think I should have gone to university right away, but instead of doing that, I buggered around fishing, and, I had a lot of fun learning back in where I was born, you know, and fishing got so good that I just enjoyed it, you know,
So when you were in Regina itself, you were working as in the agriculture still, as well, with Federal Service?
Yeah, it's called TFRA. It was the three Prairie provinces under the British North America Act. If you have more, two or more provinces in an act or a program, you can put a name to it.
Right.
And we became Prairie Farm Rehabilitation Administration. And that's where I went. There's a job there, just prairies. And the odd BC project. And I was in charge of the photographic lab. And then they put me in charge of audiovisual, you know. And then they put, you know, added on things as I went along, because I had the most guys in that information branch. And then I got into, you know, looking after some of the press people, you know, whenever we had press tours and stuff. Then I got to the point, you know, I set up so many things there that they asked me to, you know, pinch hit for the boss when he was away. I told the Director General, I said, I'm not qualified. You know, I said, I'm a photographer. He said, well, you only had 5 chiefs there, services, you know, and he said, those guys, they feel that they can work with you better than anybody else, and we'd like you to try. So I said, okay, we'll try it. Then I'll find out that pay is pretty good, you know, and I was able to do things that they never did before. I always wanted to do it, but they wouldn't allow it, you see. The boss wouldn't allow it. Finally, I ended up that he got his master's degree, and he was on his way to Ottawa to get his PhD, see. So he left, and that's why I was pinch-hitting for a year. And then finally, at the end of the year, I thought, boy, I'm going to keep this job if I can.
Right.
So they wanted me to stay, and I stayed. That's how I ended up my last 10 years in the government service.
Federal service.
I was in charge of an information branch.
Right.
And I worked twice as hard,
but
it was twice as interesting.
Right.
Yeah.
And during this time, then, you would have been part-time or with the Regina Rifles, right?
Oh, yeah. I started that before then.
Right, So you started out as, you know, commanding
PR.
A platoon or something like this? And
public relations, right?
Okay, gotcha.
And I thought, gee, that was a that's a nothing infantry officer, so
right.
I qualified myself as infantry and took me in, you know, a couple of years but I don't regret that, because every time you do something like that and you're studying, you're learning something new.
Right.
And, but, you know, while I was working, I should have gone to the university at night time.
Yeah.
Like my daughter did here.
Right.
The youngest one, well, she took a lot of her courses on nights and weekends, you know. And, in fact, of the four kids, she's got the most education of the bunch because she got her Asian degree, Asian studies degree, and then she got, her husband left, so she started to go back and get her master's in public admin and a law degree. And she did that mostly evenings and weekends.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's always something you wanted to do, too, is your university,
God, she was a good example. I should have gone back.
So when you were with the Regina Rifles, did you go to the brigade group concentrations and stuff like that?
Oh, yeah. We had Saskatchewan. We had the southern Saskatchewan and northern Saskatchewan area commanders, you know. And then we used to go on a overall thing once a year. Then we used to go to Wainwright. All the infantry units used to concentrate in Wainwright for, you know, a couple of weeks and stuff. And the CO used to go, but this time the CO couldn't go. So I went, as I was his 2AC, he sent me. So it was a good learning thing, too, because I had to, you know, deal with other colonels and stuff like this. And even the colonel from the Winnipeg Rifles that was in Hong Kong. Yeah, I was at a deal one evening and this and that, and have to sit at the same table, you know, talking. And somebody was telling me they went. I said, I understand you're in Hong Kong.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. He says, took a lot of shit there, he says.
Yeah.
But you were pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was able to talk to him about a lot of things.
Right. Okay.
And, but the infantry, they put us through, and they had every platoon commander, every NCO covered. But there are people keeping score.
Right.
And I knew that this was, I didn't even think about it, but that morning, by noon, I knew what they were doing.
What's that?
Yeah, so right after lunch, I called an old group, not for those guys, I said, I just want my guys, nobody else. So I just called the officer, platoon commanders and platoon sergeants and the corporals. I said, for a 10-minute meeting, and set it up until, I said, I don't want anybody from outside. I didn't want those guys there.
Right.
And so I said, I just wanted to tell you guys, I realized that they said they will not score us when we went there, they're scoring us.
Right.
Every one of you guys has somebody there from the regular force. I said, they're so you watch your language, the way you talk to your men, the way you issue orders, and but don't let them know that you know.
Right.
And I should make sure that they understand that, you know, you're doing a good job.
Right.
And I said, I expect you to do a good job.
Right.
And that's all. I'm not going to say anymore. Yeah. Goodbye. So that day, at the end of the day, I went to near the headquarters building. I just sat there, you know, close by, you know, just to see what's happening. All these guys are going to that building, reporting in.
Right.
So it confirmed to me that that's what's happening.
Yeah.
Well, you know, end of the day, the old man, the brigade commander, you know, called me in and said, and congratulated me. He says, your infantry company was the best in the show.
Yeah.
And boy, does that ever get to hear that report goes back, you see.
Yeah.
So as soon as I got back and we were out in the field, I got all my guys together in a little knoll, you know. And by this time, the guys were gone, you know.
Yeah.
This was the next day. It was our own, you see.
Yeah.
And so anyways, I told them what happened, and I said that, so I want to congratulate you guys. You guys did a tremendous job. And thanks very much and everything else. So anyways, this guy, the sergeant major, gives three cheers to me, you see. Then they crowd in on me, and they took my new epaulets off, and they took my wallet out of my pocket and everything else. They carried me to this lake and dumped me.
That was your way of celebrating, was it?
Yeah.
Congratulating you?
Yeah, I wish I had a picture of that. Yeah. Because, you know, it's the greatest thing that you can expect from the guys, you know.
Yeah.
So we went back happy.
Right on.
Yeah. So I learned a lot on, you know, about the area commanders, and then we went on joint, you know, night concentration in Dundurn, just north of Regina there, in Saskatoon, and all these different units. And,
right.
And I go to the old group meeting, so the, you know, the commander, you know, he said, we go to a meeting, so I'm representing, you know, me and my 2IC, mm-hmm. we're the infantry thing, we go up there to the meeting. They give us maps and stuff like this, and the route that the whole darn brigade was going to go on a route march.
Right.
And so we had to have the maps and stuff. And then they said, the magic word said, and Regina Rifle Regiment leading at the horse. Yeah. That means that's a big responsibility, because you're taking this, I forgot how many thousand men you're in, the cars, jeeps, they follow you, and it's at night time.
Right.
At night time. And they're following you.
Yeah.
I thought, oh, sure. Yeah. And then to read, you know, the thing.
Right.
Yeah, I said, so I'm keeping track of the mileage, so I got them marked out, you know, and this is where some people should jump out and say, you know, password.
Yeah.
And there is a hill there, but they won't be on this side, they'll be on the other side.
Yeah.
Sure enough, on this side, jump out and get, you know. Thank goodness, after a certain phase, the 2ICs had to take over and say, you're dead, you just got shot. So the 2IC had to take over.
Yep.
But my 2IC knew exactly the same thing that we had talked about.
Right.
So after that, I just sat in the Jeep and watched everything.
Yeah.
But it was, when they said at that time, you know, they said, Regina Rifle leading, my 2IC and I looked at each other and said, jeez.
A lot of responsibility.
Yeah, so yeah. We had to work like hell to decide what they had to do. But it was, you know, it was all part of training, you know.
Yeah.
And so there's concentrations, there are training exercises and stuff like that.
Yeah. Now, did you have a lot of men from the Reginas that were volunteering for UN peacekeeping duty and things like this, the NATO
just
brigade?
Yeah. It just barely got started. And the guy, when I was leading, it was just starting.
Yep.
Yeah. I wanted to go myself, but, you know, I left.
And lots of duties, yeah. Right on. So you ended up retiring as a major then?
Yeah.
From the rifles? Yeah.
In fact, the reason, I could have been a half colonel, but they didn't, they got a new CO, and my CO, when I was there, wanted me to take over.
Right.
But there's always, you know, the political end of the regiment, you know. They wanted somebody else. And they brought in an ordnance guy that was an ordnance officer.
Yeah.
And my officers, our officers, and our senior NCO group, matter no head, because they're waiting for me to move up.
Right.
And so I just put in my resignation because, it, you know, I couldn't stay there after that. When the guys wanted me and they brought in somebody else. So I put in my resignation and left. But then I was offered to be a staff officer at headquarters, and I still get my promotion, but it's not the same.
Right.
But I should have thought a little bit, you know. And you can be, you know, high and mighty in your thinking, but, you know, you got to look at the head features and say, well, if they get promoted to half colonel, that's what the highest you can go is a reserve thing. Heck, I've done my job.
Yep.
And I could have been a half colonel today, retired half colonel today.
Yeah.
But they ended up that I quit, so I ended up as a, you know, major.
Yep.
But when I retired and came out here, my name is on the list saying retired, you know, major, this and that. Can't speak some Japanese, you know, a little bit of history.
Mm-hmm.
So, I got a call from the admiral here saying, I understand that, you know, you can speak a little Japanese. Yeah, he says, I'd like to talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
So I went over there and said, I want you to be on our liaison team when the Japanese ships arrive.
Yeah.
And I said, okay. And he said, I want your uniform. So then he put me into Malahat Reserve, Naval Reserve. So I became a Naval Reserve Lieutenant Commander.
Right.
But I did that until I, you know, I was 65.
Yep.
Then they gave me a civilian contract. It's good, but I didn't like it. So after that, I just told the admiral, I said, I volunteer from now on.
Right.
And I've done that ever since. And the last ship that came was 2 years ago, and I did that.
Right.
So the next one that comes, it will be my last, officially. Mm-hmm. And I said, that's when I want the Navy to recognize it on a chunk of paper that I have done this.
Yeah.
So that I can, you know, put it in my records.
Yeah.
So that's what's going to happen.
Right. So, just remembering here, you were speaking Japan, or you could speak a little Japanese back in the days when you were there in the 50s.
Yeah.
How did you communicate a lot with the locals? Or did you visit your family that was there, or
was that
in Japan?
When I went to Korea, I went to Japan. Saw my uncle and grandmother, and so for the first time
right.
in my life.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And in fact, we were on our way to at that time we were on our way to Korea for a week.
Yep.
And then we were going to go on a 14-day navigational training flight to Philippines, Australia, New Zealand, Guadalcanal, Iwo Jima, and back to think for 14 days.
Right.
And I wanted to go, so I sent a signal to Ottawa saying I'd like to go. And so they told me, he said, finish a certain series. Nursing sister picture series I was doing,
yeah.
He said, do that first, then go.
Yeah.
So that's when I flew down, and we had a bunch of trees. You know, that's why I got those pictures of, you know, the wreck, you know, and everything else, and aircraft battered up. And
right.
I had to.
This was you were on the aircraft.
They yeah.
Hit a tree when they were going into land there.
Going in the fog into, it's called a DCA approach, ground yeah. control approach.
Yeah.
And Americans are talking us in.
Right.
And they talked us right into some trees, and the CEO there just saw the gloom, and he yelled for full power, and everybody was like this, you know, because you right up and
crushed into their seats. Yeah.
Hit a bunch of trees, but we had enough power to
right.
bust through. Well, if it wasn't for that, I wouldn't be here.
Right.
So then that grounded us,
yeah.
And until they can fix it enough to fly back to Haneda.
Right.
So I left there. And I said, I'm going to go see my grandmother and stuff. So right there, I left him there. But even then, on the plane, because we were stopping in southern Japan, I had a case of liquor.
Yep.
Because my uncle liked to drink.
Mm-hmm.
That whole box of liquor cost me, I think, 12 bottles, I think, cost me $18. Because certain things were only a dollar a bottle.
Right.
Other things were a dollar and a half.
Wow.
So I bought a whole case.
Right.
And I took it to my uncle because he likes to drink.
Yeah.
And right away, in a hurry, they assembled all the male, you know, relatives. The women were in the kitchen, you know.
Yeah.
But the male, and anyways, I presented, we took a group picture, you know,
yeah.
And I handed this, you know, box to him.
A gift over.
He was wondering what it was, you know. Gee, when he opened up and saw what it was, his eyes just...
It's pretty happy.
It was worth looking at, you know. Yeah.
Yeah.
Jesus. But anyways, I saw my grandmother. She died about 6 months after that.
Right.
But I went to a lot of trouble to buy a cloth and stuff for her to wear as a coat and stuff.
Right.
It cost me, you know, a couple hundred dollars, which I, you know, it didn't have that much money, but
right.
I spent it.
Right.
And saw her alive, and then my uncle, of course, and my cousins
yeah.
met them, and worked my way back to Hiroshima,
yeah.
where my mother's people were.
Right.
Met them for the first time.
Right.
So I met both the sides, you know, for the first time on that trip.
Was Hiroshima still destroyed at the time?
Nothing.
Nothing. Yeah. It's
yeah.
flat. Yeah.
Yeah. Temporary stuff and things
yeah.
like that.
Yeah.
I went to the museum there too. Not
yeah.
Oh, not that time. I went to the museum years later when I went to Morioka.
Mm-hmm.
So it was quite a few. It must have been, 25 years later I went there.
Right.
Yeah. But I looked at the museum there. Fantastic damage. Yeah.
And how were your how was the family doing? Were they employed after the war? Were they in terms of
No, my mother's side, you know, my uncle on that side had to look after the family because the men were gone, you know, they died in the war or one got back.
Right.
And in fact, one was a police chief in China, escaped to that island, you know, that...
Formosa?
Huh?
Formosa, Taiwan?
Yeah. Went to Formosa. And he went to the embassy there, and then they were after him, you see, because he was a police chief.
Right.
And one of the sailors that died, they changed the pictures and gave him
a new identity.
And he was a seaman.
Yeah.
And that's how he got back alive.
Wow.
Yeah. Of course, but anyways, you know, this was my uncle had to look after all the, you know, widows and stuff like this. So he's got all these, American Army old tires and stuff, and started making slippers out of them.
No way.
And he got trained people to do that.
Interesting.
And finally, that's one of the things he did. Yeah. Another thing was he had the wooden shoes that went back to the wooden geta, you know. He got lumber and he had this factory going where they cut these tiles. And he had piles of it along the canal, you know, by the house, drying out. And then he had the other family, you know, cleaning it up and drilling holes and then painting it.
Right.
And he went all over Japan selling them. That's how he made his money to keep that whole clan, you know, alive, yeah.
So was there any tension that you were coming from, you were a naturalized citizen of an allied country?
Yeah.
Was there a strange tension there between you and your relatives?
Not with my relatives.
No.
You know, they may have been thinking something, but they were happy to see me in that was a relative and stuff like that. But I heard about some of the people from Japan, they were kind of pissed off with us, you know, at the Canadian war. But most of them were happy to see us.
Right.
You know. But that was the toughest times in Japan, and it was the Korean War that sort of helped them.
Right, the economy boosted up again. So getting to to your retirement years here, you also were part of the Sister City organization, right?
Yeah. Well,
it's Morioka, Japan?
Yeah. 1984, we got the word that... See, actually, because of the mayor of Poland, I had things to do with the city a little bit, you know, and I knew some people there and helped them, and... Mayor Pong asked me to be there when the Japanese Nitobe group had a conference in UBC and they wanted to see the mayor here about Sister City.
Yep.
And Pong asked me to be there. That's how I got involved. And then I saw Morioka people for the first time in 1984. Then they invited the city people to go to Morioka. So they went in September. This was May. They went in September, and, you know, I didn't want to spend money to go to Japan because I was trying to just straighten out here.
Yeah.
So I didn't go, but I wish they had gone. It would have been interesting. Mm-hmm. But they came in 85 after our people said, yes, we will. And in May of 85, we became Sister Cities, officially signed it. Then, so I went about the fifth year I went for the first time. Yeah. But that's just a city interesting thing because economically it was good for Victoria. Because I did a first 5-year economic study and they were bringing in to the city almost $1 million a year.
Right.
And it's been going like that on the average up and down for quite a few years. But I haven't done anything this past year there's not too many coming this year, but last year there's quite a few came. But, you know, it always averages out, you know, over the 5 years. It'll come out to about the same.
Yeah. So I understand also that you were employed with the Expo 86, as well as the Commonwealth Games here.
Yeah, Commonwealth Games, I was asked by the Ted Grant, you know, the guy. There's two books there by him.
Right.
But the federal government used to send, he was their favorite because he was really good.
Yeah.
They sent him all over the world, you know, right, different things. And Gaines came here. He was in charge of the photographic thing in the press.
Right.
So he knew I was here, so he called me. And I thought, oh, boy, I could just get one of those new cameras, you know,
right,
use it. He says, you're not going to use a camera. You're going to be a reading supervisor. That was fun, though.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed it, you know. And that July, it was just up here. I was in the Hill Range, you know. That's the area that they built new buildings for small arms contests, and then they had skeet shooting all there.
Right.
Then the rifle range, you know, stuff like this. Boy, that place was like a tinderbox. It was so dry.
Right.
And the guy in charge, the army guys, and they had night shooting,
right,
on the range without permission.
Okay.
And if there was a spark through that thing, the whole place would have gone down.
Right.
It was that tinder dry.
Right.
And the next morning, I didn't know, you know, I heard them firing, you know, stuff like this before I left. I heard about it, too. And this CBC guy says, oh, we had a hell of a great time last night. He said, you should have been here. And he says, they'd be firing, you know. I said, you were night firing? I said, Christ, you should have the fire brigade there, you know, ready. But anyways, so I went right to the office, and I know the guy in charge, and I said, do you know that? They were firing. He said, yeah, I just heard. And he says, I'm madder than all hell. And he put in a big complaint and everything else, you know, with Jesus Christ, they could have burnt the whole thing down. So anyways, I was really careful after that. They said they're going to do something. I just said, you get his permission first before you do anything. But I had a lot of fun there. Yeah, met some interesting people, and a guy from Hong Kong who was in the skeet shooting, and then one guy was in the rifle thing, you know. I said, what's it like shooting from 1,000, you know, yards? Because I said, closest I ever went, farthest I ever went was, I think, 400.
Yeah.
When we used to go 100, 200, 400, you see. Never went more than that. And that was tough enough. So 1,000. So he says, well, I'm coming up. And so he took me up there, and I looked through his sights, you know, and these great big, you know, six feet targets, you know. They look like a pinhole. I was looking down there, and I thought, how in the hell do you hit anything there? Well, you know, and they have flags along the sides, and it flutters, and they can tell how many miles an hour the wind is. So, you have a gauge, and they set the sights this way for the wind, and then, of course, this way for the height.
Up and down.
Distance.
Right, yeah.
And shit, you're like this, you know, and the rifle's like this, but you're looking way up like this.
Right.
And geez, so I fired one, and Christ, I just barely hit the.
The
I didn't hit the round part. I hit the wall, you know, target. And I thought, and I was lucky to get that much, you know, because geez, I didn't know what the hell where I was firing.
Yeah.
So, anyways, and I thought, God, and then they get bullseyes on that. I don't know how they did it, but it's very interesting. That Commonwealth Games.
Yeah.
And then that the. Expo, actually, how I got to Expo was D.C. Ferry called me.
Right.
He said, you do a lot of PR stuff for city and the province, and we'd like to talk to you. And this guy who was in charge was the retired vice admiral.
Right.
So he says, could you bring a resume and come and see us? And I said, okay. And they were talking to a few other people, too.
Mm-hmm.
So I got my resume, and I cut it down for one page, double space, just you know, bare nuts. So when I went there, you know, talking, I sent it to him. He's listening to me, but then he's looking down the list, and he's solid enough, you know. After a while, in about 15 minutes, you know, the general manager
for Scotland with the brogue. And he's been here for 20 some odd years. Yeah. But anyways, I just pretty well made up to mine pretty fast, because so he'd like to hire you. And after I finished telling him that I wasn't interested in working more than, you know, 2-3 weeks at a time.
Right, because he'd retired by this time, right? Yeah.
But they offered me such a good thing that I had to take.
Yeah, offer you couldn't refuse.
Yeah. Lots of fun, too. Yeah.
So just coming to the end, I think, of your career overview here and the interview. Looking back on your career, do you feel there was discrimination because of your ethnicity in the services or in the federal government or in the military?
I think there was a certain amount. Mm-hmm. But in the military, I only came across it when I was in the Air Force twice, I think. Mm-hmm. And once, a guy was after me to fight me for about 2-3 months after I got to Rockton.
Right.
Red-haired guy. Yep. And I would have never known until we were playing bridge, you know, four of us after, you know, hours, and this guy came. He was a little drunk anyway. And he called me names and this and that. And I just went and gave it to him, you see, and
right.
Knocked him out, you know, because he hit his head on the bedpost.
Right.
And I said, hey, guys, get some towels. So they got some towels and brought them too. And if he hadn't been the guy he was, he must have been a pretty good guy, because he told me why he was doing this. Mm-hmm. And it was because his uncle was in Hong Kong.
Right.
And that's why he was after me when he heard I was at me.
Yeah.
And he said, I could feel kind of foolish, he told me, you know. We were good friends after that. And I remember, I never forgot his name, yeah. Red McCombo.
Red, yeah.
Yeah. And so to this day, you know, I can remember his name, but yeah. If he wasn't a good man, I would have never known why he was after me.
Right.
That was the only direct thing that I had. Another one, a guy, when I was in the Beaver Barracks in a nice area, you know, moved. I wasn't in barracks anymore. I was moved uptown and I stayed in. Instead of staying in a private place, I stayed at the Beaver Barracks.
Right.
So I had my own room, had my twilight lamp, a desk, a nice bed instead of, you know, one of these iron beds, closet. You know, I couldn't ask for anything more.
Yeah.
But we were there, and this one guy there was on a Russian course or something. And he grabbed me from behind, you know, he says, I gotcha, you son of a bitch, you know, this and that. And, you know, in a way it's fun, but at the same time he's trying to, you know, he's always doing these things to me.
Right.
So anyways, I had taken enough judo that I knew that you take advantage of their strength. And so I moved forward, he kept moving and he had his arm around me. And then next time he moved, I crunched down and he went right over, you know. Yeah. And, but, you know, we were friends. In a way, we knew each other. And
yeah.
He was doing this as a lark, I suppose. But it's because of me, you know, that he tried that.
Yeah.
But it was not, I don't think it was that serious, that one. But that was the other time.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when we moved to Lethbridge, when I ran on the street, somebody called me a dirty Jap, you know.
Right.
And I was all the fighting, you know, but my friend wouldn't let me go. I said, come on, it's not... doesn't pay.
Right.
So that was the only time. Another time I was in Lethbridge on a pass to go to show with my friend.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a bunch of, you know, I was going to McGrath High School by this time. There's 2 or 3 of the guys I knew there. And my friend said, there's some guys, you know, they're looking at us, probably saying those goddamn Jaffy or something. I said, yeah, well, I know those guys. I said, they're in my class.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, years later, I asked the guy, I said, not years later, but months later, I said, remember you saw, you know, because you don't do this, you only go to Lethbridge once in a blue moon. He said, you remember seeing me in, you know, Lethbridge? He said, yeah, I remember. There's John and so-and-so and I were there and we saw you. And anyways, you're saying, you know, those poor buggers, you know, they're this and that.
Right.
But I was, my friend was saying, you, those guys are saying you son of a bitch.
Right, right.
But that's all, being honest and straightforward, and they were honest, I found out. But when I was going to high school, the teachers were good, the guys were good, they went out of their way to be nice and, you know, stuff like that. They were Mormon people, mostly. But, and then even the teachers were pretty good, you know. And that's why the teacher with the principal went out of their way to write, to make sure that I got my diploma. You know? So I think that, you know, these, actually, when we went there, the generally, the people wanted us with the promise that we'd be out of there when the war finished, that they were going to move us all out. But by the end of the first year, people were really working with us and helping us and doing everything they can to, you know, help us, make it easier for us. So after the war, a lot of people stayed there. A lot of them didn't even go back.
Right.
Yeah.
What about your mom, mother and father? Did they end up staying in Alberta?
Yeah. You stayed in Alberta. We didn't come back to B.C. There's nothing to come back to because the farm was gone and this and that. And we got paid for the farm, you know. We got $300 and some odd
right.
out of I think, I forgot how many, $50,000 that we should have got.
Yeah.
But anyways, that's the way it went.
Yeah.
And my parents, you know, they didn't have nothing, so I had to, you know. But anyways, we had a house in town and, you know, did what we can, and but people were really nice.
I
really found out that the Mormon people, I guess, and they've been discriminated against, so I guess in a way they were good to us too, you know. Yeah.
So is there any stories you can think of your military career or experiences as a Japanese Canadian that you'd like to share in closing?
You know, to look back, you know, there's a lot of times, you know, there's interesting things that have happened, you know. And I didn't get a degree, and I wanted to go to school so bad, but being involved in these things, in the redress movement, and being, you know, dealing with the ministers and, you know, stuff like that, and a lot of my education was that kind of education. When I was with the federal government, I took every federal government course there was. I even went on a senior officer's course because the deputy chief was, we worked well together, you know, and he says, we're going on this course, and I said, I'm not even qualified to go on the course. He says, you are. I says, I'm not. They won't let me, just a manager of an information branch, you know, go. Because this was just for these, actually it's for these six senior officers we had.
Yeah.
They were the only ones eligible for that course. Two, you know, we can batch, you know, cost a hell of a lot of money.
Right.
And he says, well, he says, I just promoted you, you're going. And I thought, Jesus, God, that is awesome. But anyway, he says, I'm going. So he says, I'll see you tomorrow morning. We'll figure out what we're going to do. And you know, we spent the whole morning plus. And my office was, you know, I had an office that was about this, not quite as wide as this, but twice as long.
Right.
I didn't need that, you know, but all, you know, good walls and, you know, we sat in there. And he got the flip chart. He said, okay, let's write down everything, the main thing. And so we just wrote everything down that we should know and discuss and stuff like this and dealing with administration and, you know, organization, our organization. That was the master sheet. So he tears it off and pastes it on the wall with duct tape, you know.
Yep.
Then he says, okay, we'll take number one. And we did everything we could, just talk. We sat back and he just wrote the stuff down as we talked, and we had three walls covered with this sheet. Then, but this time it was 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and it wasn't 3 o'clock, it was about 2 o'clock after lunch, and they cut them all down, numbered, you know, he numbered it, and they cut it all down, and again called the girl. His girl says, I want this all typed out, just rough. And we want two copies, one for, you know, him and one for me.
Right.
Before we went home. Poor girl, you know, she looks at him and goes down and she had staff, so she had others do it. But that's the way they got it done.
When
I went home that night, I had this thing and changed things, added things, and next morning, first thing we meet, and got that straightened out. Then I went and that was a fabulous course. I was lucky, you know. Things in my work part, for the most part, I was kind of lucky because, you know, if you didn't have people looking after me, I don't think I would have got the at least 12:30, man.
Yeah.
I think lunch is ready.
Yeah. Okay.